Sounds True presents Your Buddha Nature, Part 6, The Perfection of Kanti, Patience, with Jack Kornfield.
There are advertisements for alphabet cards and reading programs for babies in the womb. I've seen them in parenting magazines. You can start, your children can hear through their mother's belly. You can start teaching them now. So we try to hurry up and make perfect little adult children. Yet always there's a cost to this hurry, a shadow. Can you feel how painful it is to hurry? Could we honor the cycle of nature? Carl Jung, I was reading it in Marie-Louise von France's book called Shadow and Evil in Fairy Tales, all this thing about the shadow in fairy tales. And she quotes Jung speaking the alchemical teachings that haste is the devil. The devil's a figure in a lot of these old fairy tales. It says, if we get hasty, we get caught in the archetype of the devil. That is, we get split off from what is sacred. So if we're in a hurry-up mood, we say, things must be decided today. This evening I have to post a letter. I must come out in a taxi so that you can sign it because tomorrow morning it will be too late. And so on. If you get a phone call like that, you know who is behind it. Jung had a wonderful way of losing such a document on his writing desk, not even consciously putting the thing off, but just losing it, it would disappear. The devil is the archetype or the personification of ambition and haste. I'll give it to you in another form as we speak. This is from Zorba the Greek. I remember that morning when I discovered the cocoon in the bark of the tree just as the butterfly was making a hole in its case, preparing to come out. I waited a while, but it was too long appearing and I was impatient. I bent over and breathed on it to warm it. I warmed it as quickly as I could and the miracle began to happen before my eyes, faster than life. The case opened, the butterfly started slowly crawling out, and I shall never forget my horror when I saw how its wings were folded back and crumpled. The wretched butterfly tried with its whole trembling body to unfold them. Bending over it, I tried to help it with my breath. In vain. It needed to be hatched out patiently, and the unfolding of the wings needed to be gradual, a process in the sun. And now it was too late. My breath had forced the butterfly to appear all crumpled before its time. It struggled desperately, and a few seconds later died in the palm of my hand. So in spiritual practice, there is instead the recognition of the quality of patience. Someone told me that in their retreats, a lot of their meditation was waiting meditation. Waiting for this and waiting for that, waiting, waiting, waiting. But instead, it's the willingness to listen to what is, to live the questions, as the poet Rilke says, rather than the answers, to live our way into the answers. And that's the quality of patience, of being where we are. T.S. Eliot in the Four Quartets. I said to my soul, be still and wait without hope, for hope would be hope for the wrong thing, and wait without love, for love would be love of the wrong thing. There is yet faith, but the faith and the love and the hope are all in the waiting. Wait without thought, for you are not yet ready for thought. So the darkness shall be the light, and the stillness the dancing. Sometimes we think that patience means if we wait long enough, something better will come. like I'm being patient and sooner or later something good will happen. So there's a better word to use than patience, which comes from Zen Master Suzuki Roshi. He said the better word would be constancy, a willingness to be present for what is again and again. It's really what we learn in meditation and sitting, just to sit and be with what is, to bow to our body, our heart, our mind, and the experiences of the life that opens within us. That is the presence of mindfulness. Breathing in and breathing out, sadness arises and passes, sleepiness comes and goes, planning, excitement comes, a whole big fairy tale or opera tells itself, good guys and bad guys, and you know, witches and demons, and you know all that. Then it passes away again, the breath comes in and out, and then the next thing happens. Learning the quality of presence in this human life. So it says for the wise woman or wise man, those who understand, it says in the Tao, have no mind to fight the Tao. They do not, by their own contrivance, try to help the Tao along. We sit here in the evening, and it really doesn't matter what happens. Just to sit and be present. Restless mind, sleepy mind, joyful mind, planning mind, excited mind. To rest and reconnect with our being, with our breath, with our heart, with the rhythms of life. That alone, it's worth it. The Persian poet Rumi, he writes, a friend remarks to the prophet, why is it I get screwed in business deals? It's like a spell. I become distracted by business talk and make wrong decisions. Muhammad replies, stipulate with every transaction that you need 3 days to make sure. Deliberation is one of the qualities of God. Throw a dog a bit of something, he sniffs it to see if he wants it. Be that careful. Sniff with your wisdom nose. Get clear, then decide. Even the universe came into being gradually over 6 days. God could have just commanded be. But creation usually unfolds like calm breakers. What's the hurry? Where are we going? It goes too fast, doesn't it? I mean, where's the hurry? Have more what? More moments? The next one? Now the truth is, I have to give a little bit of personal revelation in this talk. The truth is that I'm sort of an impatient fellow myself. And the archetype, this is kind of being generous to myself, the archetype that I fall into, that quality, might be Hermes or Mercury, kind of the mercurial, quick messenger. And I tend to think quickly and act quickly and do things quickly, and I don't like to be late. I like to be on time. You know, and even at 51 years old, if I'm going up a flight of stairs, I take them two at a time and kind of leap up the stairs. I remember, in fact, teaching the 3-month retreats, which I did for many, many years at our center on the East Coast, every year, the 3-month silent retreat. And one day, a young man came into my interview, a yogi who was practicing there. And he said he had to tell me that he was really greatly disappointed. And I said, what are you disappointed in being here? He said, well, I've listened to your tapes for a long time. I got some tapes of yours in Germany and I listened and they were really helpful to me. And I had this whole idea of what you would be like. And then I've come and lived with you for most of 3 months in the center and I see you running up and down the stairs and running around like an Italian shoe salesman. When I listen, when I try to become mindful of my own impatience, I notice different things. One is sometimes that I'm impatient for a result. There's something I want to taste or see or have finished. But sometimes it's more than that. It's rather that I don't want to be in the present because I don't want to feel a certain frustration or pain or tension or emptiness of things not being fulfilled. You know, who am I if I'm not accomplishing something? I need to get something done. That's who I am. And I see that state, and that underneath the impatience is fear, or fear of losing time, or boredom, or lost time. What's my hurry? Because when I'm not impatient, when I'm more present, and I drive and I'm not trying to get over the Golden Gate Bridge and get to my appointment in San Francisco, I see the fog that pours over that hill, you know, when you go through the last tunnel before the Golden Gate Bridge, you know, or the amazing quality of the city as you begin to enter it. The light is always different. When I'm not impatient, there's that sense of walking or breathing or being. So the opposite of impatience is not really patience, but contentment. And perhaps a quality of wonder. It's the capacity to rest, to release our muscles a little bit, to trust, to put your bags down. You know, oftentimes it's like we're on the train and we're carrying our suitcases at the same time, you know, ready to get off, ready for anything except what's here. Or the story you've heard maybe I've told of the old man who had never flown in an airplane, old grandfather. Finally, his grandchildren said to him, you know, would you like to try it once? He said, sure. And they got a little private plane for hire, as they do for rides in a nearby airport. And the old guy got in the airplane. They took him up to fly all over the farmland and villages, the town where he lived and so forth, and landed. He was a bit nervous before he went up. Came back down and he was smiling. They said, how did you like it? He said, I really liked it. I could see the whole valley and the farmlands and the town and so forth. Were you afraid? Well, I was a little bit nervous, yeah, he said, but I never really fully let my weight down. And it's kind of what we do. We don't let ourselves be here because we're looking to be someplace else. There's this lack of contentment or trust to put our bags down, our weight down. This is from the poet Rumi again. He writes, both the rose and the thorn appear together in spring, and the wine of the grape is not without its headaches. Are you waiting for it to be different? Do not be an impatient bystander on this path. By God, there is no death worse than expectancy. Set your heart on hard cash if you are not counterfeit, and listen to my advice if you are not a slave. What sprouts up every spring will wither by autumn, but the rose garden of love needs no special season. It is always here. In spiritual life, there can be again this whole notion of progress, getting better, like science. You know, we're learning more in electronics and physics and discovering more things. And there is a certain kind of discovery. But it's the discoveries within us, the discovery of the heart, that learns what it means to be, rather than get something that's not here in our imagination. You know the famous Zen story of the man who was sitting and sitting so determined, and the master came over one day and said, you've been sitting with such determination. What are you trying to do? And he said, I'm trying to get to enlightenment. And the master reached down nearby and picked up a brick, and then took a cloth out of his pocket and started to rub the brick. And rub it, The disciple looked up and said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "I'm trying to make a mirror." The disciple said, "You'll never make a mirror out of that brick, no matter how much you rub it." And the master looked back at him and he said, "And you'll never make yourself better, no matter how much you sit. You are the way you are. A brick is a brick. Sorrow is sorrow. Beauty is beauty. Our being is our being. The idea isn't to make it into something else. It's more like gardening. You plant the seed, and the bud knows. It waits for spring, and it comes up. Even the pine cones that know how to wait for the fire that sweeps through these grasslands regularly, and then open 5 or 10 or 100 years later, and the new trees come out. Amazing, that kind of trust. So the real opening in spiritual life always happens in one place, where we are. And it occurs when we stop trying to make or do or be or become something, and we rest our hearts in the mystery of just breathing and seeing and smelling and tasting, and we are with this changing ocean of life as it is. The perfection of the timeless or the selfless, stepping out of all my plans and ideas for a moment just to see, well, what's here? Returning. I went for a little bit of time to retreat at Santa Sabina, which is this beautiful little monastery part of Dominican College, and they just built a straw bale and adobe hermitage, this tiny little hermitage that's there. And on the wall, as you go into the hermitage, there's a little Zen poem that's there in this beautiful hermitage. And it says, "In my hut there is nothing and everything. In my hut there is nothing, this empty little hut, and everything. And in this moment there is nothing and there's everything. All that's gone before us and all that will be, all that lives and breathes in sunlight and the rain and the trees and the earthworms and all that interbe with us are here." So the perfection of patience is this quality rather of contentment. It becomes useful then in our meditation or our spiritual life to study what keeps us from this trust, this ease, this contentment. How many people would be grateful for the life that we have? Or what if we had cancer, you know, those telephone calls that say your tests have come in and I'm sorry to say you have to come down because there's something that we found, you know, and then all of a sudden you hear that and it's one kind of cancer or another and all these alarm bells go off and your whole life changes and then you go down there and the doctor says to you, "Oh, I'm sorry, it was a mistake. We mixed your results up with someone else," which happens on occasion. You go, "Oh." And then you walk out like a prisoner that just walked out of prison. You open the doors of the clinic, you go back out, and the sun feels so beautiful, and you feel so happy to be alive. And what changed? Just to be alive, to walk in the sun, to hug your lover or your children or your parents, or watch the leaves fall as they are in this autumn season. Or relax your body a little bit and walk somewhere for no purpose at all, not to shop or fix something or get somewhere, just to walk on the earth. For the impatience comes from the mind. And this quality of patience that is our true nature comes from the heart. And we can trust in it in the seasons. Don't the leaves fall down just like that? Zen poem. We can trust in the rhythms of our body, the rhythms of birth and death and songs and the end of songs. I remember I told this story some years ago when I had come back from traveling in Bali with my family on sabbatical. And gee, sabbatical's an extraordinary thing for us, mostly because, like all of you, or most of us here, our lives are very busy and complicated, and there's the fax and the phone and, you know, all the kinds of things to attend to and schedule books and play dates for my daughter and, you know, this and that. And there on sabbatical, we just walked places. We didn't have a car and didn't have an answering machine. I'm sorry, there is no answering machine and no phone to answer. And my daughter, who had studied Balinese dance the last two times we've been in Bali, and at the end of the first number of months that we lived there, it was time for her recital. And the teacher said, come to the school and we'll make a recital at the stage. So we came that afternoon, my daughter, who at that time was 6 years old. And he said, well, let's get her ready for the recital for her dance. She did the pendet dance. And he came out with his wife and they began to dress her. They took off the kind of Western clothes she was wearing and put on this beautiful silk sarong. And then he put on a gold waistband. And then they had this beautiful silk shawl or silk border, and they wrapped it about 20 or 30 times around her body, and then they put gold armbands and bracelets on, and then they began to make her up, and they put eyeshadow and, you know, little curls and all these things. They like 15 minutes of just doing the makeup, and my daughter at 6 years old, she was totally pleased with it, you know, the more makeup the better. She almost swooned from the makeup, she was so happy. And they'd show her in the mirror and then put more things on and little gold things on and then a crown and these golden flowers in her hair. And then the teacher's wife took off her own golden necklace and put it on her. And meanwhile, it was getting a little darker. And I had the camera there. I was going to document this, right? Take pictures and, you know, this recital of my daughter. And it's 20 minutes and 30 minutes, you know, and I'm waiting and they're making her up and stuff like that. And it's getting darker and my pictures aren't going to come out right and I'm getting more and more impatient. And then I look up and at some point I get it. First of all, she's having the time of her life, right, as a six-year-old because she's dressed as a princess. But more than that, I realize that in Bali, when one does anything, when you get in the car to take a drive, you know, you do a blessing first. Or when you are about to dance, when you make any art, music, dance, and they don't even have a word for art, their life is filled with art. When you do it, you're not doing it to perform for other people or to satisfy yourself. You do it for the gods. And children are considered artists, so to speak, like anyone in the world. And so she was going to do a recital. And she was to be dressed as beautifully as the princess of Ubud would be to dance in the palace that same night. They put all the gold and all the love into her so that she would dance beautifully for the gods. And she did. She could feel it. And she danced in a whole different way than she ever had. You know what it's like to feel that kind of sacredness in what we do. And the difference that it makes. This is Thomas Merton. He says, if you write as I do as a writer, if you write for God, you will reach many men and women and bring them joy. But if you write for men and women, you may make some money and you may give a little someone some joy and you may make a noise in the world for a little while. And if you write for yourself, you can read what you yourself have written, and after 10 minutes you'll be so disgusted you wish you were dead. That's a writer for you. So that this quality, we know what it's like to do something for the love of it, for that which is sacred within it. When we sit and meditate, it's not for anything else but to be present or walk in meditation, to be open to this mystery of being alive, to touch or invite the divine to fill us, to honor the rhythms of our life, the seasons, gain and loss, praise and blame, summer and winter, light and dark, to feel the rhythms of the stars. And this quality of being, of constancy or trust or presence that is patience, is our Buddha nature. It is our birthright. Here is enlightenment. To be patient in that way is in a moment to become again the Buddha, to look at the world with the eyes and the heart of a Buddha, to rest on this great earth as the sun rises and sets, the moon comes up, as the Buddha did the night of enlightenment, see the light of the last morning star and become awakened. To have a newborn baby, that's a wonderful training, isn't it? Spiritual life. Hear that baby. So it's really why we come together. To remember this capacity of the heart to sit and to be as our own Buddha nature awakens. To be without argument or rejection or ambition or fear. Not even without those, because they come. You can't stop them. They come and they tap you on the shoulder and say, here I am again. You better get up and do something. There's something more important to do. But rather to rest in that knowing that's bigger than argument or ambition or fear or rejection. To sense the rhythms of our life and hold them or know them from our heart. Again from T.S. Eliot, he writes, "Blessed Sister, Holy Mother, Spirit of the Fountain, Spirit of the Garden, suffer us not to mock ourselves with falsehood. Teach us to care and not to care. Teach us to sit still even among these rocks." Says a lot in this very simple line. Teach us to care and not to care. Those two dimensions of the heart, to be present with an intimacy, a respect, a connectedness with life, and not to care, which is to not get caught up and frantic and worried and so forth. One of the greatest teachings that my dear friend Julie Wester, who also is one of the Spirit Rock teaching collectives, passed on to me. She's been a hospice nurse for many years, among other things. And she said that when she comes into a home to set up the care for a dying patient in the hospice work, one of the most important things she tells people is that from now on, there are no more emergencies. Everything from now on will just be natural the way it is. There's no panic. There's no calling 911. There's no doing anything. There's no need to. There's no more emergencies. There is, can we be present for one another at this time of transition? And it's out of this that compassion grows. It's out of this that mercy comes and kindness arises. It's so good just to sit and do nothing, because we can listen and hear one another and see one another. You know how it used to be. There were the blue laws where I grew up in Massachusetts. You know the blue laws? It meant that you couldn't do anything on Sunday. Not only no liquor, no banking, no supermarkets, no business. No 24-hour banking, no 24-hour supermarkets, you know. I mean, who needs to kind of trade your commodities at 2:30 in the morning anyway, right? And you shift your funds in your mutual account or something like that. Come on. Gandhi would take a day a week just to be still. Even India was in chaos and there was huge numbers of people fighting one another and all the whole world was looking at this great rebellion and millions of people affected by it. And he'd say, I have to take a day and be quiet, thank you. Every week. And listen so that what I do comes from my deepest love and my deepest heart and my deepest knowing. So this rest, this trust, is not passive. It is really that place of repose that allows our heart to respond and not just our mind. And sometimes from that there comes powerful action, and sometimes it's just the hand on someone else that says, it's okay, it's all right. Because from this place of knowing, which is timeless and open and trusting, there comes a presence that is unshakable and unstoppable. Someone sent me this last week a picture from the North Carolina newspaper of the Dalai Lama in an embrace hugging Jesse Helms. He'd recently been down to North Carolina, and Jesse Helms had invited him down in part. Jesse Helms actually helped to arrange for the Dalai Lama to give his first address to the joint sessions of Congress. This photo was taken at a recent event in North Carolina. That's His Holiness the Dalai Lama on the left, who is known as one of the world's most saintly people, and that's Senator Jesse Helms on the right, who is known as one of the world's most stubborn and crafty arch-conservatives. Friends who attended the event said they were deeply moved by Jesse's affectionate and respectful introduction of the Dalai Lama. They assured us the affection between them was sincere and mutual. Jesse called him His Holiness and bowed to him and gave him a kiss. And a cynic might say the only thing they like about each other is their mutual political opposition to China's aggression. But people who were there say otherwise. When a pickpocket sees a saint, he sees only the saint's pockets. What can I take? But what makes a saint, is not their own holiness, but the fact that they can see holiness in everyone else. And it's from that place within us, when we're not in a hurry, that it becomes possible to see what's beautiful there in front of us, where the heart can transform what is in front of us, which it can again and again, because it rests in what is true, in what our life is really made of. And it's only here in the present, ever. Anything in the future is a fantasy, and anything in the past is a memory. But if you're interested in love or truth, or presence, or awakening, what's really valuable to be alive, it's always now and here. This is from the poet Wendell Berry. He writes, "The cloud is free only to go with the wind. The rain is free only in its falling. The water is free only in its gathering together, in its downward courses, in its rising to the air. In the law is rest, if you love the law, if you enter singing into it as water in its descent. Or song is truest law, and you must enter singing, for it has no other entrance." The law that marries all things is this poem. And in that he speaks of the law that's also called the Tao, or the Dharma, or the seasons of things of this world, of this life. Every day do something that won't compute, love the world, work for nothing, take some of what you have and give it to the poor, love someone who does not deserve it. Like it says, could it be that Jesse Helms actually feels the Dalai Lama's respect and goodwill, and he then responds from that best part of himself? Ask questions that have no answers. Invest in the millennium. Plant sequoias. Say that your main crop is the forest. You know, that you will not live to harvest. Put your face in the 2 inches of soil that will build under the redwood trees every 1,000 years. It's from Wendell Berry. Let's sit for a few minutes. And you can be patient or impatient as you like. And as you sit, just being, breathing, allowing this life let us also do a bit of reflection. Where are you most impatient in your life? Just reflect about it for a moment. See the situations or scenes. And ask yourself, would it serve better yourself and other beings if you could rest more in your heart, if you could find a sense of ease or trust in that situation? How would that be? What might you have to accept in order to find that trust? Can you honor this too? The fear of failure, loss, loneliness. To hold all that that keeps us moving in our heart. And then reflecting in the opposite way, remember back over the last days, for some time or moments when you were really present, just here, and what that felt like. How it was to live in that way. Again, coming back to your breathing. Letting go of the images and thoughts. sitting for a moment, resting in your own Buddha nature, with as much love and compassion and mercy as you can give to yourself. And this life.
This concludes part 6 of Your Buddha Nature with Jack Kornfield. Our program continues with part 7.